This is Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Rank and File Radio is a weekly program covering labor issues from national and international perspectives. We are your hosts, Doug Nesbitt
and Andrew Stevens. Today we speak with Robert Hickey, an associate professor in the Industrial Relations Program at Queen's University, about anti-labor legislation in Canada and the U.S. But first, here's this week's labor news update.
On the evening of Thursday, March 22nd, Federal Minister of Labor Lisa Raitt disembarked at Toronto's Pearson Airport to three Air Canada ground crew slow-clapping her in response to her back-to-work legislation against Air Canada ground crew, baggage handlers and mechanics, and pilots on March 14th. Air Canada suspended the three workers as Raitt called them animals in the process. Shortly thereafter, 150 Air Canada ground crew began a wildcat strike and took to marching through Terminal 1, chanting "Fire Lisa Raitt" and demanding the suspensions be lifted. By Friday morning, dozens of workers at Pearson and across Toronto joined the protest, which had grown to over 300. The wildcat spread to Pierre Trudeau Airport in Montreal, Jean Lesage in Quebec City, and Vancouver International. Dozens of flights were cancelled. Tory Cabinet Minister and President of the Treasury Board, Tony Clement, was held up on the tarmac in Halifax for 2 hours on Friday morning, and when he arrived at Pearson that same morning, he was heckled by workers. By mid-Friday, union reps from the machinists called for the wildcat to end. Whether this was to save face publicly, given the financial threats of an Industrial Relations Board ruling, or a more pernicious effort to curb rank-and-file militancy remains unclear. The wildcat led a number of activists in the Toronto area to occupy Lisa Raitt's riding office in Milton, Ontario. Her office voicemail was overloaded with phone calls, many of them consisting of nothing but slow clapping. The wildcat ended early Friday afternoon and succeeded in transforming the suspensions to suspensions with pay. The mainstream media also reported that 37 workers fired for the job action were immediately reinstated, but this is disputed by an on-the-ground report that they were merely disciplined.
The closure of three Avios plants 2 weeks ago, with the loss of over 2,400 unionized jobs, continues to fuel opposition against the federal government. Hundreds of laid-off workers, mainly from Montreal, protested on Parliament Hill yesterday, and the mayors of Montreal, Winnipeg, and Mississauga have petitioned the government to intervene. The federal transport minister, Dennis Lebel, has promised a commission to investigate the matter, but has given no timeline on the investigation's report. It now appears that Air Canada has been anticipating the shutdown for some time. Having relied on Avios to maintain much of the airline's fleet, Air Canada will now be moving maintenance operations to Premier Aviation in Windsor, which employs several hundred non-union workers. It's also been revealed that the federal government contributed $4 million to the construction of Premier Aviation's maintenance hangar in Windsor, the largest in Ontario.
QP79, representing Toronto's 23,000 municipal inside workers, votes today on the City of Toronto's so-called final offer. The offer contains many concessions, and the union has not instructed its members to vote either way on the agreement. There is a strong possibility that QP79 will be joining Toronto library workers on the picket lines soon. The Toronto library workers' strike, which started on March 19th, has managed to avoid the public backlash that Toronto's municipal workers received in the summer of 2009. Among the library workers' supporters in the strike is renowned Canadian author and outspoken defender of public libraries, Margaret Atwood.
QP 4207, Unit 3, at Brock University, went on strike Monday, March 26th. The union, which represents 38 English as a second language instructors, had ratified a collective agreement with Brock University on February 28th. Subsequently, the Brock Board of Trustees voted to ratify, subject to change in the document, withdrawing its former approval for the tentative agreement. Last-minute negotiations broke down on March 25th. The union is in favor of negotiating with the mediator, but the university has refused to respond to the mediator's overtures. The union is launching a legal challenge against Brock University for violating labor law. Supportive trade unionists and students have helped the striking instructors maintain picket lines at the university.
In 2011, the Canadian Auto Workers and the Canadian Energy and Paper Workers Union entered discussions on a possible merger. Together, both unions represent over 350,000 workers. In January of 2012, they released a discussion paper titled, quote, "A Moment of Truth for Canadian Unions," which outlines the current state of unionism in Canada. The paper is telling of the main challenges facing labor organizations in the country and the chief obstacles to a revitalized labor and union movement. Chief among the concerns is the declining rate of private sector union density, which stands at 17%, well below the overall rate of 30%. As the report reads, quote, "After 2 decades of fighting mostly defensive battles against the pressures of globalization, employer aggression, hostile government policy, and public cynicism, the trade union movement in Canada faces an enormous and historic moment of truth. Part of the hostility identified in the report includes the Conservative government's repeated use of back-to-work legislation in the past 5 years, as well as the introduction of essential services laws across the country. The report also points to the paralysis and dysfunction of existing labor centrals, and the lack of coordination between trade union activities. Importantly, the stated purpose of the new union is not to create a bigger organization, but a union founded on modernized practices, models of organizing and servicing, and rebuilding the trade union's image with workers. In other words, a so-called culture shift among staff and local union leadership. But the creation of larger merged unions is not new. In fact, both CAW and CEP are already products of at least a dozen amalgamations between trade unions. The question is whether or not the new union, with an expanded membership base, visibility, and resources, can organize new members and reverse the declining union density rate.
As the movement to recall Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker continues, some are questioning what the outcome of this will look like if Walker is removed from his position by the electorate. Writing in Labor Notes, Eleni Shermer, a member of the Teaching Assistants Association in Wisconsin, asks if a successful recall will be enough to undo the governor's anti-union and anti-worker legislation. Act 10 effectively eliminated collective bargaining, removed fair share dues deductions, and required 51% of eligible members in every bargaining unit to approve a union's recertification every year. As part of a wider austerity agenda, Walker cut over 50,000 citizens from the state's health care program and introduced $1.6 billion in cuts to public education. On top of the recall campaign, Governor Walker is also facing investigations of illegal activity in his administration during his 2002 to 2008 service as Milwaukee County Executive, including 15 felony charges against former staff. Walker has opened a legal defense fund in his name, something elective officials may only do if they are being investigated for a violation of the law. Eleni Shermer had this to say about the recall movement and criminal investigations into Governor Walker when she spoke with Rank and File Radio.
Among the things that Act 10 took away were not only the collective bargaining, but also the fair share dues payments for unions, so that ordinarily a union would collect dues from every member who is eligible to be part of the bargaining union, whether or not now you have to elect into the bargaining unit to pay the dues, and it puts a huge amount of financial stress on the unions. So that's one huge component that was also included in Act 10. It reduced public wages and benefits for the public sector employees. It cut a significant amount of funding to public service services like the state healthcare program, cuts to the public education system. So Act 10 was quite comprehensive, and the Democrats don't have a unified stance against Act 10. For example, Kathleen Falk and wanting to restore collective bargaining, but the Democrats as a whole have not come out saying that they will reverse Act 10 in its entirety. They're trying to kind of walk the fine line of both defending union rights and also not wanting to come out too strong in favor of unions. We have seen a great atrophy, and it's really shifted the focus of what unions can do. At least what our union can do is a pretty small union, because we now almost all of our energy is been diverted to basic survival of making sure that we can get enough members to rejoin the union so that we can, afford to stay, to be financially solvent. The recall movement has collected in total about a little over 1 million signatures. I think it's 1.12 million is the exact number. The legal requirement to trigger a recall election is 540,000. So they've over more than doubled the legal requirement. That 1.12 million signatures is about the same number of people who voted for Governor Walker in the 2010 elections. Because the volume of signatures is so incredible that the government office that is handling these signatures has to file for an extension because they can't process the volume fast enough. The Democratic Party, of course, has played a big role, but it's moved a bit beyond the Democratic Party as well, that there are a number of grassroots organizations that have fed the recall that are not associated directly with the Democratic primary. There's an organization that's quite big called United Wisconsin that is not directly tied to the Democratic Party that has been played a key role in organizing for the recall. One issue that has sort of happened in Wisconsin is that the most of the major outrage at Governor Walker in after the uprising last winter in Wisconsin, the kind of the next step was recall. It funneled essentially all of the energy and frustration at the governor was funneled into the electoral system. And so that has, you know, some distinct limitations if it doesn't necessarily allow enough space for the people to for the people of Wisconsin to organize or engage in as much direct action as they otherwise had been. One of the candidates has Kathleen Falk has sort of emerged as the pro-union candidate because she is the only candidate so far that said that she would veto any budget that doesn't explicitly reinstate the collective bargaining rights that were stripped by Walker. So the large unions around the state have all kind of come out rallying around Falk in this as the candidate in the recall election. Governor Walker was the county executive of Milwaukee County. There's been a number of criminal investigations into members of his staff from issues ranging from embezzlement to I believe there's some sort of small-scale pedophilia charges as well, but it's revealing a lot of information that perhaps Walker knew that his employees were engaging in government corruption and didn't do anything about it. So he's been indirectly implicated through this what's been called the John Doe scandal, where all of these members of his staff are being charged.
That concludes this week's Labor News Update. After these messages, we speak with Robert Hickey.
Deep Dark Woods take the stage at the Grat Club Tuesday, April 3rd. Drawing on old folk tradition, Deep Dark Woods capture the spirit of murder ballads and slow dance waltzes with their captivating prairie gothic sound. Tuesday, April 3rd. Doors open at 7:30. Tickets can be purchased at the Grat Club, Tricolor Outlet, and Ticketscene.ca.
All right, welcome back. Joining Rank and File Radio today is Robert Hickey, an associate professor in the School of Policy Studies at Queen's University. Prior to joining the faculty in the Industrial Relations Program, Rob was an organizer for the Teamsters Union in the United States. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I want to start today by talking about Don Drummond, who chaired the Commission on Public Service Reform and has been making his rounds promoting his recently released report. It's fair to say that the implementation of his report could lead to thousands of public sector layoffs. Is there credibility in the assumption that public sector workers and their unions are to cause or have caused Ontario's deficit?
Well, I think efforts to point fingers at workers and public sector unions in general misses the point of what's driving the financial crisis and what's the source of the financial crisis, which, of course, has very little to do with the collective agreements governing public sector employment relations. Naturally, the efforts by those who would like to dismantle union bargaining power are pointing to public sector unions as the source of the financial crisis, and we see this repeated over and over in the states, and we certainly see it playing out amongst federal public sector unions. I'm not sure that at the provincial level that the Drummond Report is of the same nature of blaming public sector unions for the financial crisis. I think it certainly and rightfully identifies a need for unions, government, and the broader stakeholder community to address the financial crisis facing the province, and those who try and use that as a point of blame against public sector unions, I think, won't find much substance in the report to support that claim, including the analysis of public sector wages. The Drummond Report cites a number of academic studies which, while there might be public sector wage premiums, The reality of those premiums are actually the absence of discriminatory pay practices in the public sector, if you think about the application of pay equity laws. A number of reports over the years have looked at public sector versus private sector compensation rates. And if you hold all the traditional predictors of compensation, such as age, tenure, education, job classification, public sector workers do still have a premium, a sizable premium, but if you look at it through the lens of pay equity and the application of efforts to eliminate discriminatory pay practices, the only way to get rid of the public sector pay premium would be to introduce the same types of discriminatory pay practices that we find in the private sector into the public sector, and I think that would be bad public policy.
If the worst unfolds and McGuinty and whatever subsequent government decides to introduce some of these more extreme forms of financial austerity involving public sector layoffs, do you envision a repeat of what happened throughout the 90s against Mike Harris and the Days of Action? Is this going to be a catalyst for an escalated conflict between the government and unions?
Well, I think it depends upon what the approach of the McGuinty government is in terms of engagement with unions and public sector workers in general. Going in with a unilateral take-it-or-leave-it approach will certainly generate more disruptions and more conflict. But collective bargaining is a very flexible agile institution. Unions know what the conditions are, and they bargain based upon what they know to be true. And assuming that unions are not responsive to economic pressures, I think, is simply false. Now, at the same time, how you frame labor relations, whether you frame it simply as zero-sum distributive bargaining, we're going to take away from you in order to resolve the financial crisis, I think could and would lead to heightened disruptions. If you go in and try and strip workers and unions of their right to strike, as we've seen occur in the federal public sector, or the federal sector, workers will still express dissatisfaction in various creative ways. So the possibility is certainly there, but I don't think it's a preordained outcome either by the provisions of the Drummond Report or other economic factors. Unions and employers, be they private sector or public sector, have navigated very turbulent economic waters over the years. We've seen it in auto, we've seen it in steel, we've seen it in the public sector. And to one final point is that, frankly, conflict is a natural part of the employment relationship. Now you can have destructive forms of conflict, but constructive conflict, the ability of the parties to disagree and work out those agreements through various dispute resolution mechanisms, including disruptions of service, are part of what we accept as a robust industrial relations system.
Speaking of conflict, I think many of our listeners, if they've been listening to the show over the last few months, know about what's been happening in Wisconsin. Governor Scott Walker's introduction of a number of anti-union bills and legislation that has really stripped the right of collective bargaining and organizing for a number of unions, mostly those representing public sector workers. And Indiana, I believe, became the most recent state to introduce right-to-work legislation. I was wondering if you could tell us, considering that you're from the U.S. and have experience as an organizer in the United States, where did right-to-work legislation begin and how did it change the industrial relations system in the country?
That's a good question. From my perspective, the so-called push for right-to-work rules really began long before even the passage of the National Labor Relations Act in the States, the National Right to Work Association's mission is the same as employers who have resisted legalization of unions from day one. Right to work has very little to do with the right of employees to employment. It's a public policy tool to strip unions of financial resources and thereby strip unions of capacity to bargain, organize, and represent workers in a community. It has very little to do with the kind of democratic notions of access to employment. Right-to-work legislation says nothing, for example, of guaranteeing employment opportunities for workers. So if we think about right-to-work legislation as a policy tool to strip unions of financial resources and capacity to bargain, and therefore bargaining power, I think that puts it in a better context for understanding why there is a continuing push for right-to-work legislation and why that coincides with attacks on collective bargaining rights of public sector unions. They're kind of the same side of the anti-union coin, if it were. The legislation in Wisconsin had very little to do with addressing the fiscal crisis of the state. In fact, many commentators have argued that the fiscal crisis was created by government as a result of tax breaks or other changes to revenue. And therefore, blaming unions for the financial crisis was simply a charade to strip unions of relative bargaining power, because unions are one of the few institutions that provide working class people with political voice in the democratic system. So if you're a Republican, it may make sense to strip unions of their ability to organize politically and affect public policy as a result.
In the last couple of years, we've seen the federal conservatives introducing back-to-work legislation as a way of shutting down strikes or preventing lockouts in some major employers, including Canada Post and most recently Air Canada. I'm curious, how might the increasing use of federal back-to-work legislation affect in the long-term labor relations in this country? And are we going to be seeing an employer's offensive gather steam because of the government's one-sided interventions? Are there parallels with what's going on in the U.S.?
Potentially. Now, of course, Canada has always had a tradition, a more robust tradition of government intervention in labor disputes. So the practice of banning lockouts and strikes during the life of a collective agreement exists under Canadian jurisdiction labor codes, but it doesn't exist under the U.S. National Labor Relations Act. So from the very foundation, Canada's industrial relations system has always taken a more interventionist approach to labor disputes. And so in that context, the more recent interventions by the federal government follow a long tradition. Now, to the point that they depart from that tradition, I would say that most observers would argue that the nature of the intervention, indeed intervening before the dispute even occurs, and the motivations for intervention are distinct and are send a message that's much different than trying to resolve, say, a rail dispute that has had devastating economic impacts across a broad swath of society. Rather, these are interventions designed to weaken unions' ability to advocate on behalf of their members. Frankly, I don't think that the employers would choose to have such government intervention as well. That the institution of collective bargaining works when the parties work out their differences together and reach a collective agreement that is negotiated directly between the employer and the unions. And anytime you have government intervention that prevents the resolution of those disputes, I think those disputes remain, and the parties are unable to address the underlying causes of the disputes. For example, the dispute may relate to employer efforts to restructure an organization. Government intervention in those cases and referring the dispute to interest arbitration is rarely effective to address restructuring of an organization, and that dispute will go on. We saw in the Ontario colleges sector that intervention a number of years ago didn't resolve the underlying disputes, and the college system continues to have what I would call a very dysfunctional labor relations environment as a result. So to draw parallels between Canada and federal government's intervention in strikes and what we've been seeing in the U.S., I think there certainly are parallels. The conservative government's efforts to constrain union ability to advocate on behalf of workers is similar to efforts by the governor of Wisconsin to strip unions of their ability to advocate for workers. But I think it's an important difference of degrees in terms of stripping rights of collective bargaining versus interventions in strike activity.
In really in the past year or 2 years, the right to work legislation that we spoke about and a number of assaults on trade union rights in the United States have been led by the Republicans. As we're gearing up for an election, it seems that there's some silence on what's happening at the federal level and arguably the Democrats, as well as Democratic President Barack Obama, have also been part of perhaps a more silent version of it, but really stripping away the benefits and wages of private and public sector workers, either structurally or through intervention such as that of the federal civil service. And there are some critics who would say that the President Obama has really led an attack on the right to collective bargaining, the benefits of workers. Yet the AFL-CIO has recently come out with an endorsement for Barack Obama's re-election in 2012. There's also been the failure of the Obama administration to make an effective move and implement the Employee Free Choice Act, which, if I recollect, was a major cause for trade union support and mobilization during his election in 2008. What's at stake for organized labor in the U.S., and why endorse a president that is at best lukewarm with his support for unions?
Well, the U.S. labor movement has never had the kind of independent political action or a political party that is more embedded in a strong partnership with the labor movement like the new NDP here in Canada. So the shift of the Democratic Party, and it predates Obama by several decades, but the shift towards more of a conservative Democratic approach, and Bill Clinton was certainly of that mold, I think reflects the declining political power of unions to move in an independent agenda within the American political system. If you were the president of the AFL-CIO, I think you'd be hard-pressed not to endorse Obama, given the likely alternative either in a Mitt Romney or a Santorum. I think the unions rightfully understand that if the Republicans win the election, it would be like turning the entire country into the state of Wisconsin in terms of what's the likely public policy outcome of a Republican victory next fall. So given those constraints, I think the AFL-CIO did what they could in this context, which is to support someone who is least not aggressively hostile towards the labor movement. Now, that's conditional. If you were to ask, say, teachers' unions, I think they would have a different perspective on the Obama administration and the kind of vilification that teachers' unions have faced both within and across the political parties in the states, I think, is very worrisome. The failure of the Obama administration to take up the cause of the Employee Free Choice Act or any kind of meaningful labor law reform, I think, is problematic. But if you look at the kind of political state of the United States, it's so polarized. I think it's difficult to move any agenda that would benefit labor at a federal level. So lack of action isn't necessarily just Obama's responsibility. I think it reflects the real sense of paralysis and polemics that are taking place in the U.S. political system right now.
Rob, thank you very much for your insights.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to Rank and File Radio's interview with Robert Hickey, Associate Professor in the School of Policy Studies and Industrial Relations Program at Queen's University. Join Rank and File Radio next Wednesday at 5:30 p.m. when we discuss the Ontario and federal budgets and their implications for workers in the labor movement. Stay tuned to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Well, I'm a low-down truck driver, 18 wheels and a neat rider. Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy on a weary soul. Yeah, I'm burning down this highway, and I'm pulling on a heavy load. You know them high winds, high grades, I'm pulling freight, and I'm getting paid. Lord, them chicken coops ain't open, and I'm high gear, hammer down in Hammer Lane. I'm blow right past them Smokies, I got friends on the inside pulling string. I've been to Detroit, L.A., New York, Mississippi, Grand Canyon, Hoover Dam, East Texas, and Vietnam. Lord, have mercy on weary soul. Yeah, I'm burning down this highway, I'm pulling on a heavy load. Get some! Hey, this is a motor mouth coming at you. Hey, westbound, what's it looking like out your back door? Come on. I'm taking little white pills, I'm seeing white lines. You know that logbook, she is way behind. All this 18-wheeler's moving just like 18-ton falling lead. Now I'm put that hammer down, babe, because Austin's just 20 more miles ahead. I've been to Detroit, L.A., New York, Mississippi, Grand Canyon, Hoover Dam, Texas is Vietnam. Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy on the weary soul. Yeah, I'm burning down this highway, I'm pulling on a heavy load. Get some. Mercy on the weary soul. Yeah, I'm gearing her down, boys. And I can finally see, woo, hey, lights are home.